All right, this is the February 15th statutory interpretation class. Today we're doing the big pivot. We're going to be leaving behind legislative process and turning more towards actual statutory interpretive legal doctrine. Now, as we turn away from the first third of the class, I wanted to take my usual moment of looking back and summarizing a little bit more rigorously, because there are a couple of things that happened in the interim between my last lecture and today. Namely, some of you did something that just drives me nuts. You came to my office and asked great questions, and we had a good discussion that unfortunately now the rest of the class didn't get to hear. So, I'm going to raise a couple of things that were asked about in my office hours very quickly about the topics we just discussed. I'm going to hit the highlights of our last class lecture, and then we're going to turn directly towards Holy Trinity Church. I'm going to give an advance notice that this is probably one of the foundational cases we will discuss this semester. It is one of the cases that most lawyers who tangle with statutory interpretation, which as we know involves most fields of practice, this case is notorious. So I will be asking for someone to jump in with both feet. I've gotten some opt-outs, but be prepared. I will resort to pointing a finger at someone if we don't have happy volunteers. So with that, looking back, a couple of things. We've talked about the legislative process, we've talked about the degree to which Congress can exercise its powers vis-a-vis the executive to control what the executive can do, and then vice versa, how far the executive can push back against Congress when Congress has not given it a clearly limited mandate for action. Now, most of our discussion of the powers of Congress to impede the president focused on one of the most important powers, particularly during this administration, the power to hire and fire. And we talked about a small number of cases, and this is where some of the questions during my office hours came up. Folks were trying to figure out how they fit together, what they needed to know. And what I would suggest, there is a very, it's a little simple, but it's a schematic that might help you put it all together, which is just namely, think of it as like a wrestling match. Think about who wins. And to do that, I would suggest, we're talking about situations where does Congress win? And where does the president win? That's an inelegant way of simply saying which cases led the court to uphold Congress's power to limit the president's firing authority, and which ones gave the president constitutional protection against Congress's efforts to meddle in his or her powers. So in that regard, the three cases I'd like you to really have to your mind would be Humphrey's Executor, Morrison v. Olson, and the Free Enterprise Institute versus the Certified Public Accountancy Oversight Board. So very quickly, here's your chance to fire up your neurons, make sure your long-term memory storage is actually functioning. And I've been told repeatedly by learning theorists, which yes, there are people who contact professors and say, here's the latest theory on how to teach people. The best way to remember this is to call it up as you go and call it up repeatedly. So, real quickly, between these two categories, which one would you put Humphrey's Executor? The case where we had the attempt by FDR to fire a Federal Trade Commission commissioner, basically just because he wanted to. Ignoring the power of Congress to try and impose a for-cause limitation on that firing power. I'm sorry, is the hand going up? Or? Yeah. Yes?
Maybe for Congress. Congress can require the president to come up with good cause for dismissal. In this case, it would be inefficiency, neglect of duty, or nonfeasance.
So, but didn't the court ultimately say Congress could limit the president's power?
Yes.
Okay, so Congress wins here. And I would agree. Now, I am being a little bit squirmy with you guys, slippery. Humphrey's Executor also said that Congress could not limit the power of the president for purely executive function agencies. Think of, for example, the Attorney General of the United States. Congress can't say he can only be fired for good cause under Humphrey's Executor. It's a sort of categorical plug-in analysis. If it's purely executive, the president gets it. If it's a mixed function, legislative, or an actual implementation function, then Congress can impose some limits. All right, Morrison v. Olson, the special prosecutor. Yes, independent prosecutor, excuse me. Yes.
I would say that would go on Congress side.
Why is that?
Because it undoes their power to create and insulate the independent council by saying that
And I'm sorry, do you have to speak up a little bit? I'm betting you guys are having trouble hearing that.
So I think it upheld the power of Congress to create and then insulate the independent council in a way that I think can only be fired by through the Department of Justice and for good cause, probably.
And Drew is correct. Olson is ultimately on this side of the ledger because Congress the Supreme Court upheld Congress's power to create an independent prosecutor metric framework where the prosecutor cannot be fired directly by the president at will. There are some limitations. It has to be done through the attorney general, it has to be done for cause, and there are certain other bumper lanes that keep the independent prosecutor from intruding too much into the core functions of the executive. Notice categorical for Humphreys, functions for Olson. Now for our last case, the Free Enterprise Institute. Who wins that? Your finger went up automatically. You couldn't control yourself. I like that.
President.
Why?
Because they can't have double layers over there.
Right. I mean, basically, if you can't be fired unless your boss and your boss's boss both have to find for cause reasons to fire you, you basically have the equivalent of academic tenure. You can't be fired. And those, I say that as a non-tenured faculty member, so be cool with that. So with that, Free Enterprise goes on the other side of the ledger. So that gives you a sense that it's not a uniform picture. If you get tasked with representing, say for example, a certain special prosecutor who gets fired after Congress tries to protect said special prosecutor with a for-cause limitation via legislation, these are the tools you'll have to pull out to argue why the congressional law is good, or if you're hired by the White House counsel, why it's unconstitutional. Is that pulled together for everybody? Make sense? All right. Then, with that, that was Congress's power to interfere with the president. We also now looked at the vice versa situation, which, remember, talked about ways the president can exercise power through agencies to carry out legislative mandates. We talked about rulemaking. We talked about contested processes. We talked about different ways of guidance and other types of less legislative approaches. Advice, information, all fairly stuff that's routine. You guys probably knew already before you signed up for law school. But then we focused on the case that highlights the boundaries, the frontier. And that was the case dealing with the attempt by the FDA to regulate tobacco and nicotine as a drug. The Brown and Williamson case. Now, before I go into that one, I have to say, for those of you who may be thinking, my God, this is all dusty history. This happened back before I was born. First of all, this is all still happening. I'm going to a session this afternoon, a conference. We're talking about existential multi-billion dollar litigation against the fossil fuel industry on some of the exact same principles that were alleged against the tobacco industry in terms of misrepresentation, false sales of products that cause public harm. So if you're thinking about the Brown-Williamson case, think about what you would do to take that case and extrapolate it to intent by an agency to regulate greenhouse gases and impose liability on fossil fuel companies. So with that, actually, what was the holding of that case? What was really going on? And again, normally I'd say, let's talk about it. But since we have to race along, and this is a review, the key point there was, did the FDA go too far? This is really a case about ultra-virus. Agencies can only take action if they have a statutory authorization of power from Congress. So remember, we're talking about how the president can push against the legislative branch. Here the question is, how far can the president take the ball and run with it beyond what Congress specifically said? And here, it's using a statute that goes back decades to regulate tobacco as if it were an over-the-counter drug, as a prescription. Did that go too far? And here, just to pause to make sure everything's falling into a nice symmetrical framework in your brains. Very quickly, who won that case? Did the FDA prevail? I see no's, 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 no's. Everybody's saying no, that reassures my heart. As someone nodded their head and said yes, I'd have to stop and circle a little bit here. The court was very clear. Remember, Justice O'Connor wrote that the plain text of the statute, if it were applied to tobacco as written, would mandate that it be regulated as a drug and mandate it could not be sold because it could not be used in a safe fashion pursuant to instruction. And that didn't make sense, even though the plain text of the statute might arguably say that, because the FDA had disclaimed that authority multiple times while Congress was passing subsequent legislation. And in subsequent legislation, Congress acted as if the FDA did not have that authority. All a long way of saying the original Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act gave the FDA power up to a certain point, and reading the structure and the context of the act, the court dictated that the plain language of the statute was not clear enough to give the FDA this new source of authority, this new power. It was ultra-virus. So does that make sense for everybody? Any questions about that? Because we're about to turn into a different lane. These cases are in our rearview mirror. We're about to move into brand new territory. It's your last chance, until, of course, every other class for a new session, to ask about this for today. All right. That gives me a warm sense of certainty. You guys all know this deep in your hearts. All right? So with that, I'd like to turn the page, literally. I wish I could say I planned that, but no, I didn't. Today, we are turning to part two, statutory interpretation. This is, frankly, from my perspective, the heart of the class. Not because of the title of the class or because of the structure we're talking about, but because from my experience as a practicing lawyer, this was the stuff that really was the meat and potatoes on my desk every day. Knowing this makes the critical difference in being able to be a persuasive advocate. If you look at most judicial cases that don't involve beautifully elegant theories of constitutional law, such as Professor Rafe's class, they're about what does the statute say? And it's pretty workmanlike. It's pretty straightforward stuff. But you've got to have the tools to be able to make your case in that regard. So before we dive into it, I want to make sure that we realize the waters that we're about to tread into. Namely, let me just ask you to get started here. If I asked you to interpret a statute, what am I asking you to do? What are you trying to find out when you're interpreting that statute? What are you looking for, Huey?
The intent of the legislators.
What does that mean?
What they were trying to accomplish.
What? I'm not sure. How's that different?
Because there's a difference between what they're trying to resolve, like if the problems they're trying to fix, by the law, and then also what they're trying to do with the law, like the means and the ends sometimes don't align.
Okay.
But essentially you're just trying to figure out what the goal is of the legislators.
So you're trying to figure out the intent. I'm going to keep a laundry list of these terms here. And the intent that matters is that the legislators. Have I captured it there?
Yes, and that is different from purpose. And that is different from like purpose. I sort of merged the two into my own words, which was their goal. But
you will save me many pages of agony in a law review article I'm struggling with. What is the difference between purpose and intent?
So purpose is the reasoning, or the reason they, you know, were spurred to action. I think Blackstone's called it the mischief behind the statute, and it's the reason like they need a law, and it's what they want to fix. Like they want it's the desired solution, and then intent is sort of I call it means, like the way they solve it. I feel like they're really similar, so I'm just running around.
No. I think you are grasping an interesting insight. I want to make sure we don't lose track of it. Purpose is the larger goal that the architecture bends towards. It's what you're trying to accomplish in the big picture. So if, for example, I want to make law school classrooms safe, that's my big picture goal. So the specific intent of the language we're talking about might be a statute that bans the bringing of slingshots to class.
So it would be means, intent would be means, and purpose would be?
Roughly. We don't have to be precise here. I'm just trying to get big picture of things, but I've been very rude at ignoring Drew's hand. You put it up earlier?
No, I was just thinking of a different approach to the
okay.
answer of, or to the question of what are you doing when you're interpreting statute. To me, I guess, looking at it from the perspective of being a practicing lawyer, which I'm not, but be like,
yes.
figure out consequences, like, am I going to get in trouble for doing something, or my client, or do they need to do something?
Okay.
To avoid that.
So how does that fit into the purpose of interpreting the statute? What are you doing?
We're interpreting it to find out whether reliable for some sort of consequence, like punishment or,
So this is a toolkit approach. You're looking at the language of a statute to predict the consequences of actions taken that might violate the statute. So it's really, at the heart, what you're really talking about is a bit of a pragmatic approach.
Right.
Who cares what they had for breakfast that day? You just want to get a handle of what the consequences are to you or your client if you take a look at this statute and apply it to the facts at hand.
I think that's the high-level view, and then that's why I would look at like what they had for breakfast and the intent
okay.
and all that, but for a specific reason.
Okay. So, any other possible perspectives here, guys, that we captured at all? Yes?
I guess I'm just not really following how intent and purpose aren't the same thing.
What do you
mean?
As a law professor, I'm obligated to ask a question to answer your question.
So, I think that's a simple example. Like, if you intend to go to the restroom, you're intending to go to the restroom to pee, and your purpose is to pee. Like, it's the same thing.
I've got to use that one. One, I would suggest we don't need to wrap ourselves around the axle too much on the fine distinction between purpose and intent at this stage. Two, your example, the two may necessarily be congruent. There are others where you may not have that same degree of overlap, where the specific intent of a legislature to answer a particular scenario may be divorced from their larger purpose of why they created the statute in the first place. In other words, they may not have an intent on what to do about the particular size of light posts to be used in offshore oil drilling rigs, but they did have a specific intent as to what degree of safety needed to be maintained when they passed the Offshore Competent Plans Act. And you can discern purpose sometimes, even if they're quite hard to be hard to find the specific intent of actual functionalization of the language. Now, again, this is rough discussion at this point, but I just want to point out there are people who believe there's a big difference between purpose and intent. Intent is what's in the brain. Purpose is the larger aspect, goal of the enterprise. Does that help? Okay. All right, any others? You guys have been so quiet today. Oh, wait, pointing to someone else doesn't count.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, does someone have a hand up, seriously?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike, but nicely done. I'm very impressed now.
Or just the state of looking at a statute from your own means.
Sorry, I'm picturing a big circle.
Yeah.
You're fine meaning by looking at the statute to see what it's meaning.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm looking at the text of the statute to see what the words mean.
Okay. So you would look to the text to find out what the purpose of the statute is.
Well, not necessarily the purpose, but when I look at a statute, I just see a bunch of like crazy words that don't mean anything unless I sit down and like read it.
Okay.
I don't know. Statutes don't make sense to me inherently. Like, so
don't worry, by the end of the semester, they'll be completely lucid. You will eat salads for breakfast. It'll be like a crossword puzzle. Okay?
Hopefully.
But you've raised an interesting point here. Namely, you wouldn't worry about what intent of particular people might be. You just care what's on the page. And that this text drives what you think the meaning of the statute is. And it may be that the text says something that's 180 degrees opposite of what the legislators actually would have wanted in this situation. But the text controls. So I may call you Little Antonin for the rest of the semester now. So that's very much Scalia's perspective and interpretation. And that's not an insult. He's viewed as a titan in this field. Okay, any other thoughts? Have we captured it all here? Do you have a sense of the full spectrum of possibilities? Okay, because of, as always, we can torture this, and let's have this in hand when we get to our discussion about what happens in our case for today. Namely, we had the wonderfully valid starting point that intent is what the legislatures had in mind when they passed the statute. Which legislators? At what point? Does it matter which committees they were on, or if they drafted the language, or if they added an amendment, or if they sought to kill it with a killer amendment? Does it matter which chamber they're in? Does it matter if they're in a subsequent session of Congress and asking what their opinion is of what the prior Congress did, even if there's overlap in the membership? Does it matter if legislators got together in a court case about the meaning of statutory language and submitted an amicus brief saying, what are you talking about? This is what we meant. Should the court be bound by that kind of submission? If we're going with essentially communication, legislature meant A when they wrote A and they get to control the meaning, then effectively we're doing essentially psychoanalysis, aren't we? And we're doing it in the context with 535 people at the federal level. That invites, I generally suggest, chaos, doesn't it? But alternatively, if it's just the text, what about the start I described, which I have seen happen multiple times, where the legislature is faced with a situation where the text says one thing that dictates an outcome that they never, ever contemplated or would want to have, particularly for older statutes going back a century. I guarantee you, in securities law, you will find things that happen routinely under the broadly worded Sherman Act, now in the Securities Exchange Act, that the people who passed those statutes back in Teddy Roosevelt, would have never contemplated. Nonetheless, we're faced with how to extrapolate that textual language in a way that may do violence to what their actual specific intent was and the accomplishment of the purpose of this larger enterprise. Does that make sense for everybody? It's the fundamental tension of what we're going to talk about. It's what drives all the canons we're going to go through in the next couple of weeks that courts pull off the shelf to interpret statutory language. How do you harmonize text with the broader notions of structure, context, purpose, and intent? And the case for today is one of the first examples where the court essentially, according to some justices, went off the reservation. They decided to look at what the statute was supposed to do as a way of essentially, according to some, disregarding what the language of the statute dictated. So with that in mind, that brings us to our case for the day, Holy Trinity Church. Let me give you a few thoughts to keep in mind here as we go along. And these are larger signposts. They're not driving just the conversation for today, but even in our conversation so far. One, keep in mind the slippery boundary between purpose and intent. It's an interesting device for insight, although I'll tell you, legally, not many judges are going to care about fine distinctions between the two. Number two, I have to be honest with you, the dominant paradigm these days is textualism. Justice Kagan has said it. I've actually put a link to her YouTube presentation at Harvard. We are all textualists now. Justice Sotomayor will say the same thing too. That doesn't mean these other issues aren't important and they make a huge difference in other cases for you, but almost always you're going to have to start with what's on the page or the screen. And last, number three, every judge you talk to, and including our two, hopefully on March 8th, if I got that date right, they view themselves as agents, faithful agents. They are charged with carrying out the legislative directive. The legislature is supreme, and the court cannot interpolate its own desires and aspirations and wishes in contravention to what the legislature says. That makes the court an agent of the legislature, the faithful agent model. So keep those three principles in mind. Yes?
Semantics question, I guess. What distinguishes, or maybe, I'm thinking, what distinguishes a textualist who is inclined to look to external sources to determine what the text means, mm-hmm. with somebody who will look to external sources to say like what the true purpose is, like regardless of what the text says? Does that make sense?
It does. I guess if I could take your question and torture it a little bit,
yeah.
maybe warp it even a little bit. If you're a textualist, how far will a textualist go in looking outside the text?
Yeah.
What's legitimate from that model? And how is that different from someone who might have more traditionally been a more broader purpose-driven interpretation?
Yes.
And the short answer is it's fuzzy, but usually the critical battleground is legislative history. Textualists, particularly new textualists, Scalia's bent, hate legislative history. They will not cite it even if it supports their interpretation, because from their mind it corrupts the judicial enterprise. It intrudes other irrelevant information. All that really is democratically set, all that is legitimate, all that is the actually binding force of law signed by the president is the text. And what some staffer puts in the conference report is irrelevant. I think that's where you'll see the big difference. They will look to the structure of the statute, they'll look to other facts that were generally known at the time for context, but they're not going to look at things that go past that sort of bright four corners of the statute. Okay, good question, excellent question. Matter of fact, fundamental question. Any others? All right, so with that, Holy Trinity Church versus United States. I am at that moment now where I pull up my long list of opt-outs. You guys are safe for the next 20 minutes or so. Who would like to discuss this case, which I, by the way, guarantee will come up in some form or fashion in the final exam for today, this class. So it's a good one to talk about. All right, go for it.
So the plaintiff is an English director that was asked to...
Right. Small pause. Can you guys hear anything at all back there?
Right.
Project. I won't make you stand up like Professor Crump will, but.
So the plaintiff is an English director that was asked to move to New York to become a pastor at a church, which the federal government sued over because the contract to do that was preempted by federal statute, kind of barring immigration at the time. In response to that, the court first kind of looks at the language of the statute and even the title. It says it's broad enough to cover a pastor attending to his church, but the intent kind of changes things a bit.
That's right, but I can slow you down just a little bit there. No, you're getting there. I like it. And you probably will have discovered already. Oh, by the way, he was the first to volunteer, so do I give him swag today?
Yeah.
All right. And as you know, swag is totally random, so sometimes it's good, sometimes it's silly, sometimes it's bad. This is actually a Mercury dime from 1917, which is the date of our second case today, Caminiti versus the United States. So I've actually had this thing for around 40 years. I've never pulled it out of a box, so it's yours now. I don't know how much it's worth, but...
Probably worth about 10 cents.
You think so? Actually, I don't know what happened if you took it to a bank now. They'd probably go, what? And I hear the clicking of people Googling how much a mercury dime 1917 is worth. Anyway, so you were saying the language of the statute, which, by the way, everyone, I put on the website, so we have it here for our discussion. And Luke, I think what you said was the court starts with the precept, that it applies to our rector, which means the contract that the church signed to ship him over from England is a criminal act, invalid.
It starts with that interpretation, but when you kind of look closer at the language of the statute, the title itself, it kind of shows a different intent from the legislators.
So I want to make sure, by the way, I think I've given you this advice before. If you're ever faced with a statutory interpretation question, silly as it sounds, it will save your bacon to actually sit down with a blank piece of paper and just write out the words of the statute, because it forces you to slow down. Oh, oh, Mike, that just hurt. Oh. Is that a surface that just bit the dust? Okay. Because if it's broken, I was gonna claim it. Anyway, it helps when you look, because it lets you focus on words that the eye otherwise slides over. So let's do that exercise here. We have the incredibly appropriately named, I wanna make sure I get this right, Warren Walpole, is that correct? Walpole Warren. Sounds like he walked straight off of Downton Abbey, doesn't he? Downton Abbey. So, question is, does this language apply to a contract by the church that was signed after this law went into effect to actually ship them from England to Manhattan? This church is still in Manhattan. To be their rector, essentially minister to the flock. And here's the language here. It will be unlawful for any person, company, partnership, or corporation, in any manner whatsoever. You can tell I'm verbally underlined as we go along here. To prepay for the transportation or in any way assist or encourage the importation or migration of any alien or aliens, any foreigner or foreigners into the United States, under contract or agreement, parole or special express or implied, may previous to the importation or migration of such alien or aliens. Here we go. To perform labor or service. Again, if you're writing this down, you put those labor and service in block and capital letters. Of any kind in the United States, its territory is just going to be. And Luke, I think circling back, you're saying that the court started with a preposition, preposition, proposition. I told you I was in a fight today. That this plain language seems to apply to it, doesn't it? And going to Mike's point, we're done. Let's lift our hands, go home. Class ends early today, right? I'm kidding, please. So, how does the court slip the noose here?
Well, it says that the common understanding of the term labor or laborers doesn't really include preachers.
I'm sorry, they don't labor?
But it's the common understanding, it's the plain language of the text.
What is common understanding? I'm sorry, when I do this, this implies skepticism, it's not my wrist hurt.
Basically, it's asking us to look at the plain language and to interpret that they were intending to stricture this language relatively broadly.
All right, so plain language, did they start by saying the plain language here seems to apply?
Yes.
And that's not saying to help.
They say after they reiterate the title and say obviously the thought expressed in this.
I'm sorry, they reiterate the title?
The title of the act, yes, sir.
So, plain language, I guess they originally talked about section one.
Yes, sir.
And then now we're talking about the title.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anything else? That's kind of a thin read at this point.
They also discuss briefly the context of the statute itself.
That what was happening when they passed the statute?
Yes.
Okay. So what was that context?
They said that it was in light of corporations outsourcing the labor of immigrants, which drove down production costs and broke down the labor market.
So the evil the statute targeted was essentially mass corporate importation of cheap labor to break the market.
Right.
Okay.
Congress was in.
Before we go, it can't resist. Where did the information came to support that? Did they cite the New York Times?
Not particularly, no.
Where did that come from?
I couldn't really tell you exactly. I don't know if they cited any
Well, keep going, but I'll ask anyone else here who has their book open, find the source of the information that, oh, the hand has already gone up. I'm impressed.
Was it another court case that U.S. v. Brown?
Written by?
Mr. Justice Brown.
That's right. A district court, but notice he's now Justice Brown. He was sitting on the bench for this opinion. Essentially, our justice was writing an opinion that cites his fellow judge sitting next to him. I will gently suggest to you that you will find many opinions go out of their way to cite other justices as a way of perhaps building support for unanimous opinions. Also, I can't resist noting this particular justice. Justice Brown was actually an admiralty lawyer from Michigan. He wrote Plessy v. Ferguson. So, there's some interesting history here. He was in the majority for Lochner v. U.S., which hopefully you guys recovered all right, Professor Wright's class. So there's some history here baked into the opinion for some of the odd choices made for the support. So that was almost a swag-worthy answer. You think you should? This is my last piece of swag, so be sure careful before you give it away here. No? Who says no? All right. With the understanding, this one is actually for the Caminiti case, which we'll probably have a few minutes at the end of class for. No, not Ken Caminiti, although I like your baseball lore there. No, this is Caminiti versus U.S., which deals with Mann Act violations for the importation of women for sexual and moral purposes across state lines. So we will talk about that hopefully at the end of class, but the closest thing I could find was sci-fi movies, which this one has various ones dealing with, I think I may have grabbed the wrong disc. I had one about Planet of the Amazons, but unfortunately you get Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. It's a classic. It also has Teenagers from Outer Space on it. All right. I'm sorry, we've got off track. So we've got plain language, we've got title, we've got the evil. Anything else? What is that?
The kind of returns the bill without any form of amendment.
Okay.
And the United States argued that if they meant for it to be manual labor and manual service, they would have said so, but they didn't.
So they're pointing to a committee report which basically talked about the fact that this language was written too broadly, but they had the time to fix it.
Right.
Okay.
The court says that most likely that amendment would be struck down, and the committee likely thought that labor and service was broad enough to only concern manual labor and manual service.
Okay. And is that it? Anything else?
His final point, which is a little weaker one in my opinion, is the one that talks about Congress, or the country being founded on religious ideologies and principles, and there's no way that the legislature would have intended someone to, not be able to practice religion over here, especially in a predominantly Christian nation.
Why is that weaker?
Sorry?
Why is that weaker? Given the context that this opinion came down.
Well, it's strange.
By the way, for those in the back row who can't see, at the bottom I wrote godly here. So, okay.
Well, it's strange that they speak to how religion is respected or enshrined sort of historically in the country, and then cite the First Amendment of the Constitution saying that Congress shall pass no law respecting religion. It seems somewhat counterintuitive, or at least contradictory.
I will suggest gently have a conversation with Professor Ray about the role of religion in the legislative process in the early history of the United States. State legislatures went out of their way to incorporate religious elements for the actual legislative process. And I'll also suggest if you look at the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and the Religious Land Use and Civilization Persons Act, and even our Vice President Mike Pence, you might find that there's still some strong belief into the historical roots of the nation for Christian tradition, which is what the judge justice is pulling on here to interpret the terms of the statute's sort of context, background. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just simply saying most, including myself, who read this opinion, they get to the last part and they sort of speed read. You know, come on, let's get real. We're a godly nation. We're going to use that as a lodestar for interpreting our statutes. For the time it was made and for a larger spectrum of opinion, this carries a lot of weight. So anyway, is this it? This is the toolbox. Anything else?
That's all I caught. I could be completely overlooking something.
Oh, no. Have confidence. If a judge asks you that, you say, absolutely, Your Honor. I've got it all. All right. So, notice what's happened here. We effectively have a court starting with a proposition that the plain language of the statute applies to rectors. And then says, but that can't be right. So here are the ways we're going to step up a layer of abstraction and find ways to read this language in a way that denies its facial plain meaning. By looking to its title, spoiler alert, titles are considered weak evidence at best of any kind of intent for a statute. Let's look at what the statute was designed to tackle by looking at the historical context and citing another judicial opinion rather than any independent source of information. How far can a court look to find non-record information to interpret a statute? Then this is the hallmark. For the first time, the Supreme Court cites legislative history in this fashion, a committee report, to accomplish the statutory interpretive task. And then finally, the notorious language about the religious dimensions of statutory interpretation. Now, before we delve any deeper, I have to ask, show of hands, how many are persuaded by this rationale? If you were on the bench, would you have joined this opinion? One? Any others? Two? Error? Sorry. I assume you're not. Four! Three! Four! All right? All those who think that this opinion is not persuasive, raise of hands. Okay, so a lot of you are just abstaining. Fair enough. But majority here, for those listening to the audio, I'd say 90% of you think that this opinion doesn't carry water. This unanimous, seminal Supreme Court opinion. Why? What is it about this tool chest that fails to persuade?
So, I think their fifth argument about this appeal to the American ethos of being a state that's really intricately trying to church, it completely undermines their argument textually in Section 5, where we're just this Christian nation, where it's these fundamental principles. And how in Section 5 would we not this red border passing?
All right. Roy, you've introduced a new element here, Section 5.
Yes, where they specifically enumerate the positions that are going to be exempted from the statute.
So here we go, like we're talking about here. Section 5, notice an incredibly broad net here where it uses the word any multiple times. And now we get to, but we're not going to apply this to professional actors, artists, lecturers, or singers. Or persons employed strictly as personal or domestic servants. What? I'm sorry. So your point, Roy, is?
So I guess the court addresses this that there's a fairly loose interpretation you can have of the term lecturers, but still, if you're going to have three paragraphs talking about how important church is in the nation, how would rectors or pastors not be specifically delineated?
Okay, so I want to make sure we tease this out because we will circle back to this. This will be one of those view state deja vu things. You're saying in Section 5, Congress specifically exempted particular categories. Stay with me right by Brexit part.
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, by not including rectors in this list, Congress did not mean to exclude. Right. Silence has some substantive content.
I'll probably butcher the term, but I remember in some of our textual analysis in other classes, there was this canon of construction for certain omission that if there are going to be other similar subject matter that are specifically mentioned, then the failure to mention that subject matter means it's not covered within the subject or the other ones that are listed.
I just find that this is in conference.
It was.
Okay. Fair enough. That's a nice, clean, crisp, simple way of saying the Latin version, express illius, which is the doctrine we'll talk about. Essentially, when Congress says things in one way and fails to mention others, it intends to exclude the silent parts. So, by not including lawyers are not protected from this statute. If I try to hire and bring over an attorney from London, I'm committing a criminal act.
because lawyers are not mentioned here. I catch the flavor of what you're saying.
Yes.
And that's why you think this overall argument doesn't hold water, because Section 5
clearly shows that raptors are covered.
Yes, I think that if they had stuck to the first two to four of your arguments up there, they would have been fine, but I think 5 is the best of me, I think.
So this one just left a bad taste for you. What was, did you say it was number 1, 2, and 4?
2 through 4, I think are fine.
2, 3, and 4, but not this one. The plain language part. Okay, sorry.
Yes, I think they would have been fine with 2 through 4 if they hadn't ceded that rectors were included based on the plain language. It talks about the notes that based on the labor and service definitions that there is potentially workable to not include a rector in that definition instead of just saying, yes, the statute should apply here, but surprise, we're not going to do it. Like, I think if they had maybe made a weaker argument in plain language and saying it's workable with labor or service in the United States, that a rector didn't apply, and then supported it by saying, well, here's some legislative history and this is the evil it's trying to cure, as opposed to saying rector should apply by the plain language of the statute, but we're not going to. We're going to expressly go against what the statute is saying because we believe these things. I mean, obviously they're trying to accomplish an end that they believe in. The court is like some. They're trying to get to the end and they're filling it with whatever means. We'll get to that end. And I think just not ceding their argument in the first point would make it a lot better.
So, it's bad if judges engage in results-oriented analysis. They should just follow the logic wherever it goes.
I mean, I...
No, it's not, a valid position.
Not maybe necessarily, but I think if the statute clearly points you to one direction on text and everything like that, then maybe results-oriented contrary to the statute.
Fair enough. I want to make sure, you said something at the start of your comment, and I started writing, and that's what I captured. I'll make sure I've got it accurately. The words with a meaning at the time could be read, be broad enough to include pastors, preachers, rectors, and religious ministers. Is that what you were saying? So,
I mean, that's what the notes mentioned briefly.
What is the note cite to? That'd be all I'm asking.
Cites to the definitions in Webster's Dictionary at the time about physical toil or bodily exertion, muscular effort directed to some useful end. It also includes intellectual exertion or mental effort, but I feel like that was potentially workable.
All right, so basically, though, if you're going to interpret the statute, you have to pull the dictionary in the year the statute was passed to be able to read the words accurately.
I mean, that's just...
Which again is a valid position, I'm so pretty sure.
I think maybe not today to say, oh, what does the statute mean in 2018, but this decision was 118, whatever. 1892, so a relevant dictionary at the time when they were writing this opinion would be useful, providing them some leeway to not just say, again, the statute would include this, but we're not going to do it.
Okay. Can I plant a seed with you, and we'll come back to it later in the semester?
Sure.
You assume when Congress passed the statute that they meant to pin the word like a butterfly to the board, and it was going to freeze the meaning from all time based on what the meaning was when they passed it. And that it's not possible, if Congress wanted to use a word that they knew could change.
Well, and I mean, I don't necessarily believe that
okay.
Statutes and things like that can evolve with common understandings. And
so Congress could mean a statute to mean what people think it means 100 years from now.
But even in their opinion, they say, you know, on plain language, like if you ask somebody in the street, they're not necessarily going to think a rector is included in labor or service.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, stick with that argument. Don't see your point and then support it with maybe some of these softer arguments instead of trying to build an entire construction of this statute excluding rectors and other things based on some of these weaker arguments.
So I'll cross my just one second. Circle back to you. So why would the justices choose this path? They were smart men. Think about that. There's a choice here to pick certain arguments when there might even be better ones, but you want to carry a different message. And I'll also simply note Justice Brewer was famous for being an evangelical jurist. So.
Yes.
So, anyway, Mike, go ahead.
I was going to pick up on that point that Chad just made, that, you know, it definitely indicated it's included in these editors so far. But I think the reason that they don't use other arguments, I mean, I agree that they should have been seen. If they were going to stick with this argument, they should have been, you know, be stuck with it. But I bet that they had issue with the fact that many rectors, pastors, ministers, and priests view themselves as a service. You know, they service God, they service the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like, I feel like there might have been an argument there where, like, the judges were conflicting with each other on that. So they have to go to these other articles, even if the plain language seems to indicate that rectors are not.
Even though it's a unanimous opinion, there's no dissent. There's
right.
No concurrence.
I think that was the product of, you know, argumentation. That,
okay.
Like, what does service mean? It means the inclusion of rectors, or it doesn't mean the inclusion of rectors. And that was probably, obviously, those are the whole cases about. They probably argued about it a lot. It came down to the fact that, yes, it includes it. So let's go to these other arguments.
Okay.
But
fair
also,
enough.
I think that Roy had a really good point, in my opinion. If this is such a godly nation to the point that, like, it permeates through everything we do, it's exactly what you said, like, Section 5, you would automatically put that in. And it would also allow, to get your point where, like, well, does that mean I can't hire a lawyer? I think that argument that Roy made actually says, yeah, you can't hire a lawyer, because a lawyer isn't one of those things. We're not saying that America is a legal nation where law is, you know, law, yeah, I don't know how you think that argument, but they're saying God is everywhere, God in mind. So you would, of course, when you take the statute of God in mind, then you would put it in there, the fact that you didn't. And you're not convinced. I mean,
well,
that's
no.
Exactly what we're saying.
But I think, like, think of it this way, there are two intersecting parts. One is the argument, which is the nature of the evil that's being targeted here, which is identified in some part by the Section 5 exemptions, is brain toilers, which would include lawyers, would include doctors, include a large variety of white-collar workers, frankly. Intersecting with the Christian nation argument, which means that if you interpret it to bar rectors, that in itself is an absurd result, given the background to this case. So you don't have to choose necessarily, the two intersect, and Brewer's taking advantage of both. But let me sort of raise a couple of points. I would like to zoom in legally and then step up a little bit more historically. I mean, keep in mind here that we've got some things that you're going to see that you need to keep track of, namely the role of exceptions to general prohibitions. The fact that Congress later subsequently amended the statute to specifically exclude rectors and ministers and ordained ministers, ordained religious authorities. Does that later amendment mean that Congress thought that the original version that this case was under did subject them to criminal liability? Does that later action inform the content of the prior Congress's language? Also keep in mind that what we're talking about here is essentially a committee report that had language that Congress didn't pass. It didn't get amended till the next legislative session. It identified language that it said was problematic because it could include ministers. And they passed it anyway. Doesn't that committee report operate with two sides? The blade cuts both ways. All this is a way of suggesting that this is part of the reason why textualists are so wary of using extra textual sources, because they invariably have elements of being able to choose from a variety of one support your argument before the others, or they cut both ways. The next thing I suggest from a larger perspective is, historically, this case may seem weird to you. Why on earth would the U.S. attorney go after our poor rector? Isn't this kind of a stupid case to be pursuing? Just to let you know, this was front page of the New York Times for weeks in a row. This is a giant cause celebre. The reason was because there was viewed an enormous problem with Irish immigrant labor. People were being brought over by enormous numbers to essentially work for dirt wages and undermine good middle class, sorry, it wasn't middle class, good normal Americans who are working for a higher wage. This was essentially designed to prevent that type of labor-breaking tactic. So this was high-level politics. Think of it, the late 1800 version of the argument about the wall. Now, with that in mind, it kind of understands this was a case that was intentionally designed to provoke a silly enforcement action. This statute was being put in the spotlight to highlight its ridiculousness. And this case, choosing this particular defendant, was meant to put it to the test. So if you think there's some weird elements to this case, you're right. But they don't change the ultimate legal analysis we're talking about here. The fact that we've chosen the worst case from one side's perspective doesn't mean that the twist would apply. So with that in mind, I'm pausing here. I know our time is getting short. I want to at least spend a couple minutes on Caminiti so we can make sure that we have a chance to talk about the impact of this case. Any questions about Alter and the Church case? Because it is one that will come back. I will say that justices, in particular Justice Scalia, but also other justices, including Justice Kennedy, cite this case as notorious for being the case that lawyers cite when they can't win an argument. The statutes against them. They wave the magic spirit of the law as a way to undermine what the text commands. So you will see it. It's sort of the version of if you can't win on the law, count the facts. If you can't win on the facts, pound the table. This is the statutory interpretation version of that. Okay. So with that, our other case, just really briefly, answers the following question. The Caminiti versus U.S. decision is a much later decision. So I mentioned briefly in passing, it deals with the ever exotic topic of adultery, fornication, white sex slavery trade, and the transportation of women for illegal or illicit purposes across state lines. This was a decision that highlights this, namely, what lasting impact does the Holy Trinity Church case have? Does it control subsequent interpretations? Does it sort of become the wellspring for other interpretive strategies? And Caminiti versus the U.S. roundly answered no. This is a case where a woman and a man consensually crossed state lines into Nevada for the purposes of an illicit extramarital relationship. So already, interesting case from that perspective factually. The question was, did they commit a criminal act? Because if you look at the Mann Act, it specifically prohibits the transport of women across state lines for broad categories and purposes like that. Now, clearly, the statute wasn't designed to go after weekend flings. It was designed to go after what was, at that time, the early 1917s version of sex trafficking. Serious problem. Nonetheless, the court said that this language, on its face, could be applied to our vacationing couple. And they refused to engage in these types of strategies of looking to the text of the statute, the title of the statute, the legislative background of the statute, the context of the statute, and said essentially, given the high purpose of the statute, of protecting the morality of the United States and the character of women, I hate to say it, that's the way it's couched, that they would stick with what the law said, full stop. Now, pause for a minute, think about that. This was felony liability. These were serious charges. Nonetheless, the statute was interpreted to apply in a context and to a fashion that you could make a pretty good faith argument Congress never meant for it to apply. But, you stick with just the text, it could be read that way. Caminiti is the counter. It's a demonstration that the court is willing, even back in 1917, remember the Mercury Dime, 1917. 1917, they were willing to forego the Holy Trinity Church strategies and stick with the statute, even with the criminal statute where you normally have the rule of Trinity, which we'll talk about later in the semester. So,
It's a live debate. These two strands still compete. Textualism has, since the 1980s, become descendant, but nonetheless, there's still a strong counter. And that's what our discussions are going to pick up on starting next week. Now, with that, I want to make sure we have time for those of you who want to go catch Metapod's lecture session. Let me offer a few thoughts for next week's reading. I'm going to suggest to you have fun with the first part of the reading, but don't worry about it. It's a fake opinion. It's not real. Every year, I have students ask me, what's the holding of the Spelunkian Explorers case? There is no case. It's a law review article. It was written in an entertaining way to highlight the different approaches you can take to interpreting statutes. So just read it, have fun with it, mark it up, read it, you know, play act it, I don't care. Focus on the case at the end. It's a case dealing with the extrapolation of older statutes to deal with adoption of children by gay couples, when the law arguably didn't permit it. And we're going to talk about how texts can be shifted over time. So, any last questions, last thoughts, things to take around? Because otherwise, the weekend is calling. All right, I'll see everyone on Tuesday. See you.